Today, the Pope made it easier for Anglicans to join the Catholic Church. The move follows years of fierce debate within the Anglican Communion, which includes American Episcopalians, that debate over issues such as gays and women serving as clergy. As NPR's Sylvia Pajoli reports from Rome, the Catholic Church is hoping to attract discontented Anglicans.
The split between Catholics and Anglicans dates from 1534, when the Vatican refused the English king Henry VIII a marriage annulment. With the new provision, Anglicans will now be allowed to come back to Catholicism. Speaking in London, Vincent Nichols, the Catholic Archbishop of Westminster, described the new provisions as a response
to those groups of Anglicans who, over the last 3 or 4 years, have approached the Holy See with a desire to find a way of coming into full visible community with the Holy See while having some opportunity to preserve elements of Anglican patrimony and spirituality and tradition.
The Vatican move comes after years of growing discontent within the 80 million strong worldwide Anglican community over openly gay bishops, the blessing of same-sex unions, and the ordination of women. The exact numbers of disgruntled Anglicans is not known. One major group is the traditional Anglican Communion, which claims to represent 400,000 worldwide, including 5,000 in the United States. The new Vatican provisions will allow married Anglican priests and even seminarians to become ordained Catholic priests. However, married Anglicans will not be allowed to become Catholic bishops. In London, the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, signed a joint statement with Archbishop Nichols, saying the decision brings an end to a period of uncertainty. But he also downplayed the new provisions.
It would not occur to me to see this as an act of aggression, a statement of no confidence, precisely because the routine relationships that we enjoy as churches continue.
But veteran Vatican correspondent John Allen says the move breaks a long-standing gentleman's agreement among divided Christian churches.
That they don't go fishing in one another's ponds, that is, they don't proselytize one another's members.
Allen says the decision is symbolically important because the relationship between Catholics and Anglicans has always been a template for ecumenical relations. And he adds there is widespread concern about what this could mean for Anglicans.
At the grassroots, I think there will be many Anglicans and Episcopalians who will see this as the Vatican sort of accommodating the dissident wing, if you like, of the Anglican Communion, and thereby potentially contributing to the implosion of the Anglican Communion.
Not everyone inside the Vatican may be pleased. At the press conference today where the announcement was made, representatives of the Holy See Ecumenical Office were noticeably absent, officially because all of them were away from Rome. Many analysts see the new move as another sign of an increasingly conservative church under Pope Benedict. It follows his recent move to rehabilitate 4 excommunicated ultra-conservative bishops, including a Holocaust denier. Both moves fit the Pope's desire to bring all the faithful back under the Vatican's wing. Sylvia Poggioli, NPR News, Rome.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It was a philosophical battle for the ages. On one side, the journalist, literary critic, and avowed atheist Christopher Hitchens. On the other, Douglas Wilson, an evangelical theologian and pastor of Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho. The topic is Christianity good for the world. The two men launched a debating tour together last fall, and the result of those confrontations is a documentary called Collision. It opens in New York and L.A. this week and will also come out on DVD. Both men are with me. Christopher Hitchens is in our studios here in Washington. Welcome.
Nice of you to have me.
And from Northwest Public Radio in Pullman, Washington, Pastor Douglas Wilson. Welcome to the show.
Good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Christopher Hitchens, the two of you went around to debate this issue. Is Christianity good for the world? You were never really meant to answer that question. I mean, you answered it and Pastor Wilson answered it, but you were never meant to come to a conclusive answer, right?
Well, I'm not sure that Pastor Wilson would say that. I think he thinks there is a conclusive answer. My view is that there are no such things as conclusive answers.
Except that there is no conclusive answer.
Except there is no conclusive answer. That those who are sure at a time when we know so much more, but about so much less, if you see what I mean. We know more than we used to, but we know now how much we don't know as well. That I think there's no role for faith, or no useful role of any kind, and certainly not the Christian one.
Pastor Wilson, you don't think religion is absurd, obviously, but you think that atheists, like Christopher Hitchens, aren't very good at being atheists either.
Right.
Why not?
The argument that I would present there is that Christopher, for example, just said that he didn't see any role for faith. Well, I would want to say that because we're finite and we all have a limited starting point, it's not a question of whether we have faith, it's what we have faith in. And so Christopher, I think, has faith in the role of scientific inquiry, rational inquiry. He has faith in that process. And without assuming that process, he can't demonstrate the need for using that process. In short, he has faith or confidence in that is going to be better than the alternative. I have faith in God. Everybody who's finite and limited has to have an axiomatic starting point. And that presupposition, that axiomatic starting point, is your faith position. And Christopher is as much a man of faith as I am.
Christopher, a man of faith.
Well, no, this is I think a slightly last-ditch argument that's becoming fashionable now among Christians, is to say that people like Richard Dawkins and myself are fundamentalists, mm-hmm. that we're believers, if you like, almost that we're a church. Absolutely not so. I mean, we don't have an authority to whom we can refer things. You're only as good as your last contribution or your last piece of research or your piece of argument. There are many things about which we disagree. I mean, atheism is compatible with any other world viewpoint, from nihilism to fascism. It doesn't commit you to anything.
Christopher, can you appreciate in any way the power of religion, the usefulness of faith as a way to sort of find order in life, even if you choose not to take part?
Oh, certainly. I mean, one of the reasons this argument never becomes tedious to me is because I have a great respect for religion and for the role it's played in the evolution of the human species. I mean, it was our first attempt at cosmology, at philosophy. It was in many ways our first attempt at literature. I can quite see how people felt that faith was necessary at a time when they knew so little. But I think that we've now begun to, it might be condescending to say outgrow it, but to transcend it.
Douglas Wilson, you talk about God in this film as an objective truth. Don't you mean a subjective truth?
No, I mean, if it were just a subjective truth, then I'm not able to get outside my own head. That means that a subjective grounding for religion is no more good for us than, say, to take hallucinogenic drugs. I could have a light show inside my skull, behind my eyes and between my ears, but that subjective reality is worthless, ultimately, unless there's a correspondence between what I'm experiencing subjectively and an objective reality out there. Consequently, I don't believe that we can reduce it to just subjective experience without tumbling ourselves into a swamp of relativism.
Christopher Hitchens, do you believe in a force, something that Pastor Wilson might call God and something that you would not call God, that can explain what we're doing here and what sort of exists beyond this universe and in the cosmos?
That force would be the dialectic between reason, doubt, science, and inquiry. I thought you were going to ask about another kind of force. I mean, I think that there is in us, equally innate, a desire for the numinous and the transcendent, so you might say the ecstatic, the things that express themselves in the form of music, love, art, architecture, and so forth. And religion can claim a great deal of credit in, so to speak, stirring and cultivating that impulse. But I think that impulse is with us whether we believe it's a supernatural one or not. I think a great cultural task is actually to come to terms with our need for the transcendent and the numinous without prostrating ourselves before gods that we've ourselves made.
But is there something, I mean, how do you explain what makes us all different? I mean, are we simply a mash of tissue and nerve endings, or is there something that animates all of us, what some people call a soul?
We are not just a mass, we are a fairly highly evolved outcome of a very, very long, very haphazard, and very cruel a process which, as you know, eliminated 99.9% of all the species ever present on Earth. I won't say created. It's a very haphazard and capricious creator at work, if there is one doing this, which I don't believe, of course. But we have a certain amount of cognition at the end of this process. We know how to laugh. We know how to think. We know how to fear. and we know we're going to die.
And it's just because we're programmed that way.
Not we're programmed. That's as far as evolution has yet brought us. Sir Martin Rees, professor of cosmology at Cambridge University, says that by the time we're about halfway through the life of our sun, and when that sun goes out, those who watch it happen will not be humans. Whatever creatures there will be as close, about as close to us as we are to amoebae.
Doug Wilson, I was struck by watching this documentary that it wasn't really about finding common ground. I mean, Hitchens thinks Wilson is wrong, and Wilson thinks Hitchens is wrong. Is that about right?
Yeah, I'd say that's right. We both disagree on a fundamental issue. And one of the things that's refreshing about talking to Christopher is he's not trying to split the difference all the time, where either if what Christopher is saying is correct, then I'm not just misguided, I'm wrong. And if what I'm saying is correct, then Christopher is wrong. The reason the thing that the DVD is titled Collision is because we're not trying to split the difference. Christopher wakes up in the morning knowing what he thinks, and as do I.
So it's really not about convincing the other person.
No, it's about learning from the disagreement.
Mm-hmm. And so yes. I guess in the end, you'll simply be judged at the gates of heaven. You'll both be standing there, and you'll find out who is right and who is wrong.
Yeah, if we're standing there at all.
Well, I'm not sure it's a zero sum as that, because the Christian account of it would leave no room for a reward for the person who honestly didn't believe. But it implies that there would be a reward for someone who pretended to believe in the hope of a reward.
Actually, I could correct half of that. The Christian faith does not hold out any hope whatever to the hypocrites or the posers, the people who just have purchased fire insurance and who want to go up to the pearly gates and then pretend that they can buffalo God. Well, God searches the hearts. So the hypocrites are not given any hope. If you read Jesus and his denunciations of the hypocrites, they were his worst enemies.
So, Pastor Wilson, is there hope for Christopher Hitchens? Is there a possibility you may meet him in heaven?
Oh, certainly. God is the God of all grace. And the Apostle Paul, who wrote the majority of the New Testament, was much more ferocious in his opposition to Christians than Christopher has ever been, until God knocked him off his horse. But the point is that Christopher is not going to be accepted by God maintaining what he's currently maintaining. So there's not a mush split the difference sort of thing.
For a moment, I thought I was copying a plea there. I knew you'd have to remind me of that.
Well, so the point is, it doesn't do any good to throw it all into this big benevolence vat and make all religions and all beliefs and so forth the same. So I'm not trying to do that at all. At the same time, Christopher and I get on very well on a personal level, but both part of it, I think, is because good fences make good neighbors, and we both understand that the other person really believes what they believe.
Hmm. At the end of this documentary, or around the end of it, Christopher Hitchens says something that was very interesting. You were asked whether, if you had the opportunity to eliminate the last religious person on Earth, you wouldn't do it. You wouldn't pull the trigger.
That's quite right. Not just because it would leave me with no one to argue with, but because, as I began by saying, religion is an enormous part of the achievement of human culture. And it was our first attempt to make sense of the world. And so an engagement with it is absolutely necessary for one's own education and for the maintenance of tradition.
And if you flip it around, if I were confronted with the last unbeliever on Earth and I had the option of persuading him, converting him, bringing him, I'd baptize that guy.
Christopher Hitchens and Pastor Douglas Wilson's new film, Collision, opens in New York and Los Angeles this week and will be available on DVD as well. Christopher Hitchens, Pastor Wilson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Guy.
Thank you.
In the early days of his presidency, Barack Obama appointed 25 people to advise him on faith issues. Among the well-known names is one that is relatively unknown. She's young and she's Muslim, and her headscarf has made her a reluctant celebrity in parts of the Muslim world. Here's NPR's Jamie Terabay.
It was seen as an historic moment, an American president speaking from a lectern at Cairo University in Egypt to the Muslim world.
So long as our relationship is defined by our differences, we will empower those who sow hatred rather than peace.
Dalia Mugahed was there in the audience, sitting in the middle, five rows from the front.
It was very surreal for me to actually go back to Egypt, where I'm from, to be treated like a celebrity. It was very different and something I'm not used to at all.
But a celebrity she'd become. To the Muslims watching her, She was traveling with the president, even though she wasn't. To them, she'd written his speech, even though she'd only contributed a couple of paragraphs. To them, she was his Islamic advisor. Again, a big no. The denials didn't matter, because more than anything, the sight of Mujahid in her headscarf, or hijab, seeming all official in Washington, prompted Muslims to think of her as something more. To them, she's the hijabi in the White House.
That's what stuck, and that's how the story has been framed ever since. I've tried so many times to reframe it and have failed miserably.
She's only met the president once, but try telling that to Muslims everywhere who see her voluntary, non-paying appointment as a backstage pass to the White House.
Everything from, my father is in jail and I want you to ask Obama to pardon him, to, I need a visa, I mean just everything you can imagine.
What she actually does for the president is work on this faith-based council. They're supposed to come up with ideas on how the American government can partner with communities and social groups. What she brings to the table is research from her polling of Muslims at her day job with Gallup. She says she's not there to represent Islam.
What I am doing is sharing with other council members and with the president the research that we've done on the opinions of Muslims around the world.
Right now, those opinions have swung sharply in favor of the U.S., Mujahid saw that firsthand when she traveled around the region right after the president's speech.
Most people no longer really questioned his sincerity, but only his ability to follow through. And I felt that that was an interesting and very significant shift.
Mujahid lives in suburban Virginia with her husband, a physician, and her two sons, who both spoke Arabic before they spoke English. She came here from Egypt when she was 5 years old. Driving to work on this rainy day, she talks about how she got interested in market research right after getting her degree in engineering.
That's really when I became fascinated by the idea of applying the scientific method to the understanding of people.
And once Mujahid started working, she knew people were going to react to the way she looks. It's always there in the back of her mind, especially when she's about to walk into a room full of suits. Sophia Klutch is her colleague at Gallup.
I've visibly seen the transformation that happens with people when they have walked in with their own perception and how that is changed and shaped by this very calm, very not passionate, not advocacy-driven person.
Mujahid knows, though, that with all her qualifications, the sight of her in her headscarf on a political council could just be for show.
It really doesn't matter why someone puts you on a council or on a committee. Once you're on that council, you can decide whether or not you want to be a token or you want to be a substantive member of that group. And I see all of these opportunities as just that, opportunities.
And all those expectations of Muslims around the world? That, she says, is something she cannot control. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montaigne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. We're going to ask next about the implications of a big decision by the Catholic Church. The Vatican is welcoming Anglicans to return to Catholicism. The public invitation comes as the Anglican Church is divided over questions like the role of gays. If some Anglican congregations become Catholic now, they could bring their Anglican priests along, and the priests could become Catholic even if they're married. That calls attention to the Vatican's longtime rule that priests must be celibate. To learn more, we contacted John Allen, senior correspondent for the National Catholic Reporter.
There have always been celibate priests in the Catholic Church. In the beginning, these were largely monks who embraced celibacy as a symbol of total self-sacrifice to the service of God and God's people. However, the expectation that most Catholic priests are going to be celibate really didn't arise until the 10th or 11th century. So it has been for about the last 1,000 years that the Catholic Church has had a fairly uniform policy that its priests are going to not marry, that is, are going to be celibate.
And what is the reason that the Vatican gives for holding to that rule even today?
Well, I think there are reasons that are both theological and practical. The theological reason is that a priest actually is married. The priest is married to Christ and to Christ's church. And in that sense, if you'll pardon the flippant expression, it would almost be kind of bigamy to have another married relationship. I think the practical reason is that when priests are not married, that means that they are kind of available 24/7 to the service of the church.
So having said that they have this reason, that the priest is married to the church and married to the calling, what reason does the Vatican then give for saying it would be okay for Anglicans, in effect, to become married Catholic priests?
It is, in effect, a kind of choice for diversity inside the Catholic Church. Now, it should be said, for centuries, the Catholic Church has had 21 Eastern Rite churches. These are churches that are located mostly in Eastern Europe. In those Eastern Rite churches, priests are allowed to be married. So there have always been, in that sense, churches that have married priests that are in communion with Rome. So in principle, this isn't any different. I think the big difference is that where those churches tend to be located in places far away from centers of media attention in the West, these new structures that the Catholic Church is creating for Anglicans are going to be located in the United States, in Great Britain, in Canada, and in those places where the debate over priestly celibacy in many ways already is the most intense.
And is that debate heating up now in the Catholic circles that you follow so closely?
Yeah, I mean, already there are a lot of people asking questions about what the implications of this move are going to be. I mean, if, for example, the Vatican says that it's not just current Anglican ministers who can be married and ordained as Catholic priests, but future candidates for the priesthood can be married inside these new structures. I mean, will you see a growing number of young Catholic men who will say, well, geez, I'd like to be a priest and I'd like to be married. Maybe I can sign up for one of these new structures and do it that way. I mean, in other words, the question that's being asked is, has the Vatican, without intending to, created a loophole big enough to drive a Mack truck through on the discipline of priestly celibacy?
It's interesting to think that you would have Anglican priests who are drifting away from the Anglican Church, feeling that they're conservative and that the Church is becoming far too liberal, and now they have the prospect of joining the Catholic Church and becoming the liberal guys who are actually married.
Well, they may be liberal on the married priests question, but on most other issues, whatever number of Anglicans actually come into the Catholic Church, they're going to end up bolstering the more conservative wing of the Catholic Church, because on most issues, particularly issues of sexual morality, they're quite traditional. And this makes a larger point, which is that in the old days, the differences that mattered among Christians were things like how much authority did you give to the Pope versus how much authority did you give to the Bible and so on. And while those differences are still around, these days the differences that actually drive behavior on the ground are more ideological. They're about the culture wars. And so what we're seeing is a real redefinition of the fault lines that matter in Christianity.
And maybe some people stepping across the fault line.
That's exactly what's happening.
John Allen of the National Catholic Reporter, always good to talk with you.
Thank you, Steve.